Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Brenda Wright, Vice President of Legal Strategies with the group Demos, who discusses the fallout from the Supreme Court's ruling striking down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act and what Congress can do to repair the damage. Matthew Lewis Rosenberg, an anti-fossil fuel activist, who talks about the origins of the Fearless Summer campaign and weighs in on President Obama's recent speech addressing climate change. And media activist and author Jeff Cohen, who examines the disturbing increase in attacks on journalists as they report on covert government surveillance programs revealed by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During the last 2 years, over 100 Tibetans have set themselves on fire in protest against China's repression of Tibetan Buddhism and banning the return of the Dalai Lama. But with the installation of a new leader in Beijing, Xi Jinping, there is now talk of implementing a less harsh policy towards the Dalai Lama and his followers. China's high security presence in Tibet and the Dalai Lama's commitment to nonviolent resistance has maintained the unrest at a low level of intensity. In recent weeks, public debate about Tibet has broken out among Chinese officialdom. In a recent interview in a Hong Kong magazine, scholar Qin Wei, director of ethnic and religious studies at the Central Party School in Beijing, has called for a new creative approach to Tibet and the Dalai Lama and a rejection of hardline tactics. Qin observed that the demonization of the Dalai Lama has backfired, turning most Tibetans against the Chinese government, even those who support Beijing's modernization policies. In essence, Qin says, the hardline stance has created an ethnic dividing line between Han Chinese and Tibetans. Many of the recent anti-Beijing protests were sparked by overt repression of Tibetan culture, language, and tradition. Hopes were high with the launch of the Democratic Party's Battleground Texas campaign, a long-term base-building initiative by Team Obama to turn Texas from dark red to blue. The key goal of the campaign is to register and mobilize the growing Latino population in a state where the last Democratic win in a statewide election came in 1996. Already, Texas is a majority-minority state with Latinos, Blacks, and Asians outnumbering whites. By the next presidential election in 2016, 1 million new Latino residents will be eligible to vote in Texas. Historically, Latino turnout in Texas has been low, even as Hispanics generally support Democratic Party candidates by a 2-to-1 margin. Texas Governor Rick Perry dismissed Battleground Texas and its goal of moving Texas from the GOP to the Democratic column as nothing but a pipe dream. But national Republican strategists do take the threat seriously and are prepared to pump millions of dollars into Texas to keep the state deep red. Most political observers agree that without the state's 38 electoral votes, there is little chance for Republicans to gain control of the White House. 50 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court banned school-sponsored prayer. But today, religions of various denominations have a presence in public schools through student clubs and outreach ministries. What began as a push by evangelical Christians has been joined by Jewish, Muslim, agnostic, humanist, and interfaith groups. The two court rulings banning school prayer, Engel v. Vitale in 1962 and Abington School District v. Shemp in 1963, have largely been forgotten. In many cities and towns, school life is now saturated by religious symbols. The Fellowship of Christian Athletes sponsors prayer huddles, which are student-led groups with coaches as sponsors. Supporters say Christian huddles promote a ministry of presence and attitude, but non-Christian athletes say they feel intimidated by huddle prayers. The return of religion to public schools has not come without controversy and opposition. So-called Christian Catalyst Clubs have provoked charges of employing aggressive recruitment tactics pursuing students, which some parents characterize as religious harassment. It's not uncommon for Christian youth groups to refer to public schools as a target or a battlefield. While a 2002 National Network of Youth Ministries recruitment manual states that Christian students have been sent to establish a strategic beachhead so that they can penetrate and saturate the entire school with the good news of Jesus Christ. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
With their narrow 5-4 ruling on the constitutionality of the 1965 Voting Rights Act on June 25th, the majority of conservative justices on the U.S. Supreme Court effectively gutted the landmark civil rights legislation designed to prevent discrimination against the nation's minority voters. Specifically, the court ruling challenged the formula in Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act that determined the list of states and other jurisdictions mandated to receive special scrutiny of any proposed changes in their voting laws. Striking down the Section 4 formula, the Supreme Court decision in effect invalidated Section 5 of the civil rights legislation, which required preclearance of new voting laws in jurisdictions with a documented history of discrimination, protecting voters' rights before they are violated on Election Day. Now it's up to Congress to replace the formula struck down by the court. Since 1965, the Voting Rights Act has been renewed and amended by Congress 4 times, the most recent being a 25-year extension approved by Congress with overwhelming bipartisan support and signed into law by President George W. Bush in 2006. In a sign of how quickly the court's ruling will affect local election law, the state of Texas declared soon after the decision that a voter ID law that had previously been blocked under the Voting Rights Act would go into effect immediately. In her dissenting opinion, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg stated, "In the court's view, the very success of the Voting Rights Act demands its dormancy." Ginsburg went on to observe, "Hubris is a fit word for today's demolition of the Voting Rights Act." Your reporter spoke with Brenda Wright, Vice President of Legal Strategies with the group Demos. Here she discusses the fallout from the Supreme Court's evisceration of the Voting Rights Act and what Congress can do to repair the damage.
You know, I guess not to mince any words, this really was a dreadful decision that's going to do real harm to real people by rolling back protections against racial discrimination that have been absolutely central to the progress we've made as a nation in protecting the right to vote. The decision, by just a slim 5-4 majority, it invalidates a provision of the Voting Rights Act that determines which states need to get federal approval before making any changes in their voting laws. And that was first enacted in 1965 after, you know, years of evidence that it was needed, because in certain states, you know, every time there was a court order striking down some discriminatory voting law, the state legislature or the local government would just go back and enact a new law to replace it. So the Department of Justice couldn't keep up with it. Private litigants couldn't keep up with all of these discriminatory enactments. And so since 1965, a number of these jurisdictions have been required to get advance approval in a, you know, pretty streamlined process, actually, where they just need to demonstrate that the law is free of discriminatory intent or purpose, and that prevents the discriminatory changes from going into effect in the first place and avoids the need for protracted, you know, lengthy litigation to decide the issue. So it's been widely recognized as one of the most effective civil rights laws ever enacted. And, you know, its demise is a real blow to our democracy.
According to some analysts of this ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court, the door remains open to changing what's called the coverage formula that the Supreme Court struck down. But then, of course, there is the larger obstacle of a Congress, which is fairly dysfunctional and polarized, where coming up with a new formula seems unlikely, at least in the short term.
Well, you know, I'd say a couple of things about that. I mean, I think it's really important to see this decision, you know, not to just mourn it, but to organize, as the saying goes. And I think it's got to be seen as a call to action. And it really does put the burden on Congress of stepping forward to respond to this law. And you know, I mean, I understand what you're talking about in terms of skepticism about Congress's ability to act, but the truth is that this area is really a little bit different than a lot of others. Over the years, there's been a really incredible, you know, bipartisan support for the Voting Rights Act. When it was reauthorized in 2006, it was, you know, 98-0 in the Senate, and it was approved in the House by a vote of 390-33. And in the previous reauthorization, which was signed by President Reagan, he said that the right to vote is the crown jewel of American liberties, and we cannot see its luster diminished. So there's been a very strong record of bipartisan support for the Voting Rights Act. It's really been kind of an iconic feature of our commitment to civil rights. I think a lot of Americans take pride in it, and I think there is reason to hope that Congress can come together in a bipartisan way and repair the damage that's been done.
Now, in regard to things being better and the issue of, you know, we're in a post-racial, discriminatory United States of America, and a lot of people on the right who approved of this ruling say, hey, African-Americans, Latinos, and other minority voters were coming out in record numbers in the last couple of elections. They're not being stopped. But on the other hand, of course, we have a record-breaking number of fairly obvious discriminatory measures, both in terms of voter ID laws and new rules governing voter registration and early voting, that seemed very obviously targeted to limiting minority voters in a whole range of jurisdictions, mostly put in place by Republican state governments. Do you want to mention your concern here with the abrogating, you know, at least in the short term, of the Voting Rights Act here, and how it's going to affect what happens next in a lot of these states that are already moving to implement laws that were previously blocked by the Voting Rights Act?
Yes, it is really sad to see how quickly some of these jurisdictions are stepping forward to say we're going to go right back at it. And, you know, Texas is an example where literally the day after the decision, their very onerous voter ID law had been blocked by a Section 5 objection and by the action actually of a three-judge federal court, which found that enactment to be discriminatory. And as soon as this decision was announced, Texas is back out saying, yeah, we're going to go ahead and implement this. And, you know, not just Texas, but Mississippi has now announced that its ID laws, they're going to go forward with that. There's concern about South Carolina rolling back improvements that it had to make in its law in order to get approval from the federal court. And, you know, in the short term, we're seeing already the damage that this decision is going to do, and that just increases the need for Congress to act swiftly to respond.
That was Brenda Wright, Vice President of Legal Strategies with the group Demos. Find more views on the Supreme Court decision on the Voting Rights Act by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. This summer is witnessing stepped-up opposition to the use of fossil fuels by many communities and activists around the country. According to the world's scientists, the continued exploitation of oil, coal, and natural gas will eventually heat up the planet's climate to the point of no return, where life on Earth will be endangered. Actions being organized as part of what's being called Fearless Summer are targeting proposed coal export terminals in the Northwest, mountaintop removal mining in West Virginia, oil pipelines in Maine, tar sands development in Utah, and many more. Some actions involve nonviolent civil disobedience and arrests. The protest campaign began in late June and will continue throughout the summer, with the peak coming later in July with the group 350.org's Summer Heat series of events. The summer actions coincide with President Obama's recent speech outlining his plan to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, and with his administration due to make an important decision on the future of the controversial Canada to U.S. Keystone XL tar sands pipeline project proposal. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Matthew Lewis Rosenberg, an anti-coal activist with RAMPS, Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival, based in West Virginia. Here he explains the origins of the Fearless Summer campaign and weighs in on the substance of President Obama's recent speech addressing climate change.
Fearless Summer is an open-ended call for united and escalated action around extreme energy across this country and even across the continent this summer. So it's not convened by any one organization. It has no funding or decision-making structure. It's a completely open-ended collaboration from grassroots organizers across the country opposing all kinds of different dirty energy projects. And one of the central pieces of this is to present a united front on energy extraction, to say we're not willing to trade one community's suffering for another. So it's organizers working on fracking and coal and pipelines, industrial biomass and oil, and really all the dirty energy industries coming together to say we reject all of these as solutions. Nuclear power is not an answer to climate change. Gas isn't better than coal. And also for everyone to sort of step up their action in whatever way makes sense for their campaign. We have endorsing organizations from Sierra Club chapters to Earth First chapters. And everybody's taking different kinds of action that are appropriate for where they are under a common banner, sort of show the power of a movement that's becoming both bigger and more united. So Fearless Summer was born out of a meeting that happened in upstate New York in February. It was the first extreme energy extraction summit to bring together organizers from all over the country working on issues around dirty energy, energy extraction, to have a dialogue and begin to speak a common language and to find sort of innovative collaborations that could make all of our work more powerful by being in communication and collaboration with each other. And so a breakout group at that meeting came up with sort of the first idea for unifying around sort of public action and civil disobedience. And out of the conversations that started there with a wide range of groups from 350 chapters to Food and Water Watch, to Ramps and Tar Sands Blockade, and any number of other organizations, a series of weekly calls began that eventually became the Fearless Summer campaign.
So if all fossil fuels are left in the ground and we don't go nuclear, what would that mean?
We don't claim to have a blueprint for exactly what a no-carbon future looks like. We do know that we have to find that solution if we're going to have a livable planet. And if our communities are going to have an intact environment to support us and the next generation and the generation after that going forward. So we have to find the solution. And there are models out there. You know, there was a Scientific American article where someone published a plan to get the world carbon-free and nuclear-free by 2030 or 2050. There are proposals out there. It probably looks like a lot more distributed generation, the use of true renewables, a ton of energy efficiency, and probably some minor lifestyle changes as well. Energy efficiency is really the name of the game, using less power. And even with current technology, from the things that I've read, we can cut, you know, 40% of demand out with energy efficiency alone, which would be enough to shut down the whole coal fleet. So, I mean, we think the solutions are out there. We think it's the political powers that be that are preventing those solutions from flourishing and the bold steps from being taken that need to be taken. And so what Fearless Summer is all about is pushing back against that entrenched political power to allow the solutions to emerge. Fearless Summer is all about lifting up local campaigns and frontline voices. And so if people can't take an action during the first Fearless Summer week of action, that's fine. People need to do what makes sense for their struggle and their campaign. It's an open framework around the unity of our movement that people can use as they will throughout the coming months.
Matt Lewis Rosenberg, what did you think of President Obama's recent speech about climate change?
Well, I don't think there was anything in the president's speech that we didn't expect to a certain extent. Obviously, there are a lot of positive aspects of it. I think we can use it to help continue to build this movement. But the plan itself, while containing some important steps, is woefully inadequate. I think we were all particularly disappointed, though not surprised, at his re-endorsement of natural gas and hydrofracking as a bridge fuel. Not only is hydrofracking destroying communities across this country, but the idea of a bridge fuel at this point in the climate crisis is absurd. We don't have the time for the supposed bridge to be another fossil fuel that's still contributing to climate change. With methane leaks, there's serious doubts about whether, particularly in the short term, gas is any better for the climate than any of the other fossil fuels. And once the infrastructure investments get made that are getting made across this country in natural gas, people are going to want to hang on to that infrastructure investment as long as possible. So building a brand new pipeline, a brand new gas-fired power plant right now, isn't a bridge fuel that's locking us into fossil fuels for the next 30 to 50 years.
That was Matthew Lewis Rosenberg of the group Radical Action for Mountain People's Survival and the Fearless Summer Campaign. Find links to organizations working on climate change issues by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, stranded in a transit terminal at Moscow's International Airport, continues to seek political asylum outside the United States as the Obama administration pressures nations around the world to deny his request for refuge, reportedly made to 20 governments. Last month, Snowden revealed details of the U.S. government's previously unknown massive collection of domestic and overseas phone and internet communications. The Obama administration has responded to the unauthorized revelations by charging the 30-year-old former technical assistant for the CIA and recent employee of a government defense contractor with three felonies: espionage, theft, and conversion of government property. Snowden has become the eighth person to be charged by the Obama administration with crimes under the 1917 Espionage Act, more than double the number prosecuted by all previous U.S. presidents combined. As world media outlets follow Snowden's every move, the U.S. corporate press has focused a great deal of attention on the activities of journalists like the British Guardian newspaper columnist Glenn Greenwald, a primary source for the publication of Snowden's surveillance revelations. Government officials and some journalists have condemned Greenwald as being complicit in exposing U.S. government secrets, urging that he be charged with a crime. Your reporter spoke with Jeff Cohen, founder of the media watch group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and the senior producer of MSNBC's Phil Donahue show until it was terminated on the eve of the Iraq War. Cohen, who now serves as the founding director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, discusses the disturbing increase in attacks on journalists as they investigate and report on covert government surveillance programs and their possible civil liberties violations.
I thought in the first couple of days there was actual coverage of what the revelations were about. But in recent weeks, what the media have focused on in the mainstream is largely, how do we catch this guy? How do we bring him to justice? And I'm using the pronoun we, not by mistake. This is often how people on mainstream television talk about the U.S. government, the Justice Department, the spy agencies. They use the pronoun we. One of the examples I use in my article is this fellow who's a talking head on CNBC and a New York Times columnist and reporter named Andrew Ross Sorkin, and he commented on CNBC, "We've screwed this up, even to let him get to Russia. We've screwed this up." You know, the last time I checked, that particular journalist was not, you know, working for the CIA or the FBI. He was working for the New York Times and CNBC. So there's been a real obsession, I think, with how do we catch this guy. For much of the country, this guy, Edward Snowden, is somewhat of a hero, somewhat brave. He revealed information about the NSA spying on millions of Americans or keeping track of who we're calling and how long we're calling and storing that data. That's really important information. And if we had a mainstream media that was more independent of the power structure, they'd be focusing on what do these revelations mean. Instead, what we're getting from the mainstream media is often it resembles state-controlled media. It's looking at this story not from the perspective of the half of the country that sees Snowden as a hero, but looking at this story from the government elite that's trying to stem these leaks.
Jeff, you mentioned at the outset Andrew Ross Sorkin's attacks on Glenn Greenwald as being the messenger here of Edward Snowden's reports, as was the Washington Post. It's interesting they don't get as attacked as much as Glenn Greenwald, who writes for the Guardian newspaper in the UK. But there was an extraordinary exchange between David Gregory on Meet the Press. I saw this exchange that maybe you can recount for us and its importance, given that Glenn Greenwald, very quick on his feet, responded to David Gregory's statement asking Glenn Greenwald why he shouldn't be arrested and thrown in prison.
Yes. The host of NBC's Meet the Press, David Gregory, says, "To the extent that you have aided and abetted Snowden, even in his current movements, why shouldn't you be charged with the crime?" That was a question from Gregory to Glenn Greenwald. It's factually misleading because there's no evidence that Greenwald has, was helping Snowden in his current movements. It was, how long have you been beating your kids, when you don't have any evidence there's ever been any beating of the kids. Greenwald responded, "I think it's pretty extraordinary that anybody who would call themselves a journalist would publicly muse about whether or not other journalists should be charged with felonies," unquote. So what you have here, I think, and it's almost unprecedented in American history, recent American history, that the administration, the executive branch of government, is seeking to criminalize the practice of investigative reporting when it's regarding national security in any way. And you criminalize reporting by saying that any reporter that gets a leak, as Glenn Greenwald did from Edward Snowden, and Associated Press had their problems with this administration, that any reporter who's getting classified information is, by practicing journalism and publishing information that the government doesn't want public, that they're engaging in crime. And it's been an unprecedented attack. James Rosen at Fox News had his email content seized and his phone record seized. Several reporters at Associated Press have had their phone call record seized. And here you have mainstream journalists encouraging the public to view Glenn Greenwald as a criminal for engaging in the practice of journalism. We have now a situation where the Obama administration has prosecuted more people for espionage, more whistleblowers, people inside the government, trying to intimidate people that have information of wrongdoing, trying to intimidate those individuals on the inside who have information about wrongdoing from turning it over to journalists. And now the Obama administration has made that next step where they're seeming to view journalists as criminals, journalists who engage in adversarial reporting. So we're a couple steps down the road to serious interference with the First Amendment, and you have many people in the mainstream media encouraging the slippery slope to criminalizing journalism.
That was Jeff Cohen, director of the Park Center for Independent Media at Ithaca College, and author of the book Cable News Confidential: My Misadventures in Corporate Media. For more commentary on government whistleblowers in the media, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.